Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. For months, the two biggest pieces of President Biden's legislative agenda have been stalled in Congress as Democrats argue over the cost. The cost is enormous. There's the trillion-dollar infrastructure bill to build roads, bridges, and other projects supported by both Democrats and Republicans. That one has already passed the Senate, but is essentially being held hostage by Democrats in the House who want an upvote on a broader spending package that they believe will positively impact the lives of most Americans. Progressives are in disagreement with moderate Democratic Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona over the price tag. A lot is riding on this, including the success or failure of the Biden presidency and the Democrats' prospects in the midterms. Americans are watching the numbers being batted back and forth, but not many people actually know what is in these bills or how their lives would change if they passed. So this hour, we push aside the price tag a little bit and take a closer look at the contents of what some have described as a once-in-a-generation investment. Deirdre Walsh is congressional editor at NPR's Washington desk. She joins us this morning from D.C. Welcome to you.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Mike DeBonis is congressional reporter for The Washington Post. He, too, is in Washington. Good morning to you.
Yep. Thanks, Mike.
You're welcome. And Dr. Eric Heberlig joins us. He's a professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. Welcome back to the program, Doctor. Good to see you.
Nice to be here, Mike.
Deirdre, to outsiders way out of Washington, this all looks like Washington as usual with all this gridlock going on and nothing getting done because nobody can decide on anything. And then we have this obstruction between Democrats and Republicans. But this time the obstruction is occurring not only between the two parties, but within the Democratic Party. And I just went through all the things that are at stake here. How unusual is it for a political party, or specifically for the Democrats, who are not known for being able to march in lockstep, for them to be so at odds with each other that they are jeopardizing their own success?
I don't think it's that unusual. I mean, we've seen divisions inside the party. There, you know, there's a wide ideological spectrum inside the Democratic Party. You have the progressives on the left who are pushing for a much broader sweeping bill that expands the role of government. And then you have, you know, the centrists or the moderates, like the ones that you talked about, Senator Sinema from Arizona, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, who just fundamentally disagree about the size and scope of the package. So, I mean, we've seen it in the past on the healthcare debate. I apologize. Somehow my dog got out.
I was going to ask, who has the dog?
I apologize for him. He somehow managed to weasel his way into the front of the room. But I'm just to get back to the differences here. I mean, we've seen these in the past when Democrats put together the Affordable Care Act about 10, 12 years ago. There were those big divisions then, and we're seeing them again now.
So I should ask you if the dog has a name and if it has credentials for this conversation.
He has a name, but he does not have credentials.
So the tug of war, Mike, is it just over the price tag among Democrats of the second bill, the social spending or the domestic policy part of this? Is it just over the price tag, or is it, as Senator, I think, Manchin has mentioned several times, over the fact that a lot of this has the appearance of creating more entitlements?
Yeah, it's about more than the price tag for sure. And Joe Manchin, more than anybody else, has been forthright about sort of detailing his policy objections. Like you said, he has talked about this notion of creating an entitlement society, and he believes that some of these programs would extend or create new federal benefits that people would feel entitled to. That's not something he agrees with. But he also has said that he's for a lot of this. He's for the child tax credit. He's for programs for kids and for elderly Americans that, could help make their life easier. I think what he's been more skeptical of are benefits, particularly ones that might accrue to people who are farther up the income scale, people who are more solidly middle class and the upper class. The other thing that Senator Manchin has really raised concerns about are the climate provisions. You know, he's chair of the Energy Committee in the Senate. He comes from a fossil fuel producing state. And he's been very clear that some of the cornerstones of what Democrats are looking at, particularly these initiatives to get fossil fuels out of the electric power industry, are not ones that he favors. And I think that's a real thorny policy debate that Democrats are working through, in addition to all this debate over entitlements and social spending. Any climate provision is going to have to meet Joe Manchin's muster, and that's going to be interesting.
But there are a lot of provisions in this domestic policy part of this bill that's in the reconciliation bill. This is very confusing, but there's a lot of stuff in there about electrification and better and fixing the grid so that electric cars will have more sources of power, etc. And surely people in West Virginia see the end of the coal empire coming like a freight train down the tracks. Surely they see that. And there is a way for them to participate in this new electrification economy. I mean, the solar and etc. Is that even part of the conversation? Is that even a concern at this point? Or is it just fear over the loss of coal jobs for Joe Manchin?
Well, you don't have to tell West Virginians that the coal industry is in decline. You know, the industry has lost thousands of jobs. It's clear what the arc of the coal industry is. I think to Joe Manchin, though, to make a policy decision to move away from that without looking at other alternatives. Mm. And he has, talked about, carbon capture, some of these alternatives that sort of mitigate the effects of fossil fuel use. I think that he would not, he's not up for accelerating this trend, even if the trend is obvious, let's put it that way. And he has talked about gas, natural gas as well, not just coal. Typically, the way he puts it is he's for an all of the above energy policy. And what that means is that he's not for anything that phases out fossil fuels, but he isn't against encouraging renewables.
Eric, the bill that passed the Senate and is waiting for passage in the House and will be passed in the House if the moderates and the progressives can agree on the social spending package in the other bill. Because it's the infrastructure bill is being held hostage, but that bill contains bridges and roads and other hard infrastructure that almost every community in America can use, including Charlotte. We've heard about what's in that package. We hear that the ideas being floated in the domestic policy part of this are popular, fundamentally really popular among most Americans, but they also don't know that they're in this package. Does that surprise you? Here the Democrats offering up what the president has called the biggest fundamental change in America since the New Deal, which was Franklin Roosevelt's time, and nobody knows what's in the package. They only know it's a big price. Why?
Well, transformational is a big term, but it's also nebulous. It can mean anything to anybody. So this package really has a bunch of different sections to it. It has a lot aimed at parents. You mentioned the child tax credit, but it also has child care, universal pre-K, community college. So that's of interest to a lot of people. It also has healthcare-oriented stuff, home health care for the elderly, adding dental and eye and hearing to Medicaid. So that's very interesting, particularly to the elderly and to kids who have parents who are facing home health care situations, which is a lot of families. Mm-hmm. You also mentioned the climate change. So there's just a lot of stuff in it. So it probably took me 2 minutes to list all those things. And when you're messaging politically, you want something short, quick, and snappy that can summarize it. And in a package this broad, it's not terribly easy to do that.
Yeah, but why aren't
the Democrats,
they even? But they're not selling it at all. The president's not going around the country stumping for it. No individual Congress people are stumping for it. I think I can't think of his name now, but there's a Democratic apparatchik from the Clinton years who said they ought to be doing this. They ought to be out there saying, standing in front of broken down bridges that people recognize in their own community and saying, "You see this? We're going to fix this." Why aren't they doing that?
Well, even more simple things. Like when I got the call to participate in the show, I thought, well, I'll look up what's in the bill. I went to Democratic websites, National Democratic Committee, House Democrats. They have lots of themes. They don't talk about this bill. So if you go to Democratic messaging sites, they're not even pushing the particular contents of this legislation. So yes, it's a messaging problem. Yeah. Part of the problem is the message is complex and they haven't figured out a way to simplify it in a way that it sells to people.
Deirdre, it's easy for us to sit here in Monday morning quarterback all this, I suppose, but when you talk to people in Congress, Democrats in Congress, are they aware of how woefully insufficient their messaging has been on this?
I think they do understand that the public is having a hard time wrapping its head around what's in this bill. And I think they admit that up until now, the debate has been about the number, about the top line number. Originally, they looked at a $3.5 trillion domestic spending package, things like universal pre-K, free community college, you know, paid family leave, all these things that we just talked about. But when all you're covering or all the debate out of Washington is over, is it going to be a $3.5 trillion package? Is it going to be a $1.5 trillion package? I mean, they understand that that fight has overtaken the substance of what's in this, and they're really trying to turn the corner now to talk more about what their priorities are. The problem they have about specifics is they're not sure what is going to end up in the final package. It's pretty clear this is going to have to be scaled back. It's not going to be a $3.5 trillion package anymore. So now the debate is, do they include all of their priorities for a shorter amount of time? Or do they do fewer things for a longer amount of time? And that affects the cost of the package. And that affects like what they can say is in it. You know, will they end up having 2 years of free community college? Maybe not. Will they have the child tax credit? That seems to be one thing that they agree is, you know, a very fundamental and popular piece of this package that, you know, Americans are already used to that benefit. It came from an earlier coronavirus bill and they're trying to extend it. So yes, the messaging is definitely a big hurdle that they have, and they're definitely aware of it.
So the other thing that we know, because it's in the news every day, is that this is a fight among progressive Democrats and moderate Democrats, Mike, and the moderate Democrats, the two stars of that fight, are Kyrsten Sinema from Arizona and Joe Manchin from West Virginia. And they are in the Senate. It's progressives in the House that are digging in their heels on passing this legislation unchanged, although they're not going to get their way. But are there moderates in the House who also would vote no on this? Or is it just these two senators standing in the way?
No, there is a group of moderate House Democrats. There's a couple of different caucuses, you know, the Blue Dog Democrats, there's the Problem Solvers group, and they have tried to use their leverage to, advance their own views on this. You know, we saw it earlier, late in the summer. They tried to arrange it so the bipartisan infrastructure bill that passed the Senate over the summer would pass before moving on to the other bill. That's what sort of led to this dust up a couple weeks ago, that, you know, where the progressives said, dug in their heels and said, no way, we're not doing that. And now they're, we're now back where we started.
Mike DeBonis covers Congress for The Washington Post. Deirdre Walsh does the same for NPR. And Dr. Arap Heverlig is here. He's a political scientist from UNC Charlotte. We'll be back in just a moment at Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about what's in this reconciliation bill, also known by several other titles, the domestic policy bill, the social spending bill that's being held up by progressives and moderates, Democrats in Congress. Deirdre Walsh reports on this. She's a congressional editor for the NPR Washington desk. Mike DeBonis is a congressional reporter for the Washington Post. And Dr. Eric Heberle is with us this morning from UNC Charlotte. We know, and we'll get to the particulars of what's in this bill in a second, but we know that the infrastructure bill has a lot of money in there, Eric, for things that we need. Our airports are old and out of date. Our roads are in need of repair. There are hundreds, maybe thousands of highway bridges that are on the brink of being unsafe. Cities around the country, including this one, have a desperate need for money to improve mass transit. The Senate approved a $1 trillion bill that's being held hostage by these discussions in the House. How often do bills of this size for those types of expenses come up in Congress? How big an opportunity is this?
Well, it's a big opportunity, and both parties have talked about doing infrastructure bills for years. They agree on the roads, the bridges, even the broadband. What they haven't agreed on is how to pay for it. So the Democrats now have a way forward to pay for it. That the hang-up is not really anything about the transportation bill itself, but the strategic use of this bill as leverage to get the social spending bill so that everybody in the Democratic caucus gets at least something of their priorities out of the Biden presidency.
Yeah. And that's what's at risk here, the Biden presidency. If they fail to pass these two bills, then he's gotten very little done, at least in the eyes of people who listen to his campaign promises. And that's what's at stake. What's at stake? We don't know, Deirdre, exactly what Kyrsten Sinema wants out of this. Evidently, she's having private conversations with the White House, but no one can seem to nail her down publicly on what she wants. We know that Joe Manchin has several problems with this. Among them, we talked about a moment ago, the fact that he thinks that this leads to more entitlements. Are these entitlements?
I think it depends on who you talk to. I mean, I think, you know, Budget Committee Bernie Sanders sees this as the government's role. He believes that there should be expanded coverage for things like hearing, dental, and vision care. He thinks that's the government's role. Joe Manchin thinks that there should be some limitations. He thinks that there should be what he calls means testing or work requirements for some of these government benefits, that they should be targeted to working families at certain income levels. Just going back to the Manchin and Sinema question, I think that for months we've put both of these moderate Democratic senators sort of in the same category because they have both expressed concerns about the overall price tag of this. But if you look at sort of their policy priorities, they aren't necessarily on the same page. Mike DeBonis talked earlier about Manchin's positions on energy policy. Senator Sinema has in the past promoted climate change policies, and that is one policy area where they might not be in the same place. She has expressed support for some of these climate change programs, these new programs. And so we don't know the specifics of her policy proposals, but based on her past positions and in conversations with some of her colleagues who have talked to her, I have heard that that is one area where she is more in line with some of the things that the Democratic caucus wants. If you look at prescription drugs, that is an area where they may not be on the same page. Senator Manchin has said he does believe that the government should be able to negotiate the prices for prescription drugs, that Medicare should be able to negotiate that. Senator Sinema, according to some of her colleagues, it's hard to get a lot of details from her personally. She has expressed some reservations about that policy. So we have to just go back to the issue that Democrats are using this process called reconciliation to get around a Republican filibuster. So they need all 50 Democratic senators, but on some key policy areas, they may not all 50 be on the same page. So that's a very, very hard needle to thread right now for the White House and for Senate Democratic leaders.
So the way this Build Back Better bill is written, it's $3.5 trillion in expenses for these social programs, among other things, and it's paid for in part by some tax adjustments, particularly on the wealthy. But Senator Manchin wants to take it down to about $1.5. It'll probably come in around $2 million. Put those numbers into perspective, because average Americans, including me, can't figure this out. Is that a lot of money? And when we talk about what we spent over the last 10, 20 years on the war in Afghanistan, what is $3.5 trillion in comparison to that, Mike?
That's an important question to ask. I mean, the very notion of a trillion-dollar bill was really anathema even 10 years ago. I think back in 2009, when President Obama was trying to put through his stimulus bill after the global financial crisis, they internally knew that going over a trillion wasn't going to work. They were trying to get some Republican senators on board this bill, and you know, it ended up right around 900 billion. And now here we are after the coronavirus pandemic. We've passed multiple pieces of trillion-dollar plus legislation in the last 2 years, and it's really pretty astounding the way that has changed. And, you know, the difference between a $3.5 trillion bill and a $1.5 trillion bill is obviously massive. I mean, it's look at it this way, more than two of the 2009 stimulus bills that, had a pretty significant impact across the country. But even, if you take the perspective of, what good can a $1.5 trillion bill do, it's still pretty massive. But it's all judged in the sort of through the lens of prior expectations, and that's a big issue of what Democrats are dealing with right now. They've set this $3.5 trillion number, and now people are feeling pretty dejected that some of the things they talked about, like a Medicare expansion to include dental and vision benefits, is maybe left on the cutting room floor.
The billion-dollar recovery bills that were paid out to banks and to General Motors, et cetera, at the depths of the Great Recession, there was much hand-wringing and decrying of the fact that we can't afford this and blah, 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 and we shouldn't be bailing out these big companies. But all that money was paid back with interest. I believe the government made a profit on that. How are we paying for this? Because this is much, much, much bigger than that. And as you said, Mike, we've already laid out trillions of dollars in recovery money because of the pandemic. Where's this money coming from? Are we borrowing all of it?
So for the relief and recovery bills that were passed, have been passed so far, the CARES Act, the American Rescue Plan, that was all deficit spending. None of that was really paid for. What Democrats are saying is that their domestic policy bill, their infrastructure bill, both of those pieces of legislation are offset with a variety of new things. For the domestic policy bill, they're looking at tax increases on rich Americans, on corporations, closing some loopholes. They're also looking at this prescription drug, negotiating prescription drugs with Medicare, is potentially generating hundreds of billion dollars in savings that would offset this new spending. So what President Biden he's going around and saying that this bill is paid for, that this will not add to the deficit. There is going to be some creative accounting involved in that, talking about the economic growth and things like that. But unlike these previous relief and recovery bills, they're making an effort to offset the cost.
Of course, we had tax cuts under President Trump that the Republicans flocked to without questioning it, pretty much. And this bill contains a tax cut for Americans making less than $400,000 a year, which is most of us, lowering the price of prescription drugs, as you mentioned, universal pre-K for 3 and 4 year olds, child care for working families, tuition free community college for 2 years, investments in the housing trust fund, which are earmarked toward increasing the stock of affordable housing, upgrades to veterans facilities, help for small businesses to get access to credit and entrepreneurs to get access to credit, and much, much more. Deirdre, these seem like, for average Americans, a great opportunity to improve their lives. Do they know that? I know when you mention these programs out of the context of this bill, they go, yeah, I'm in favor of that, most of them, 70% of them. Do they know that's in the bill?
I don't think they do. I mean, I think that when you ask Americans, and there's been a lot of polling on sort of the big pieces of this package, they are popular. They have bipartisan support in a lot of instances. But I think you're right. I think it goes back to the messaging discussion that we had earlier. People don't understand what is in the bill. Even in the case of the child tax credit, that was in one of these coronavirus relief bills that Mike just mentioned. There have been polls out showing that that's a very popular, but also that Americans don't necessarily give Democrats or President Biden credit for that policy. I mean, that was a bill that they passed in an earlier version of reconciliation where they passed it just with Democratic votes. So people are getting this benefit, but they're not necessarily connecting it with the Biden administration or the Democrats who control Congress right now. So they certainly have learned through that experience, and even in the past through the experience with the healthcare law, that a key part of their job is to explain what people are getting and explain who gave it to them.
Eric, Democrats say this is the biggest, most massive push toward benefits for the average American since the New Deal. The New Deal brought us Social Security. I can't think of what else they brought us that has lasted this long. I know Medicare came around during LBJ's time in office, another Democrat in office. This sounds infinitely bigger than any of those things because it's so much in one package. Is it?
Well, it's certainly aimed at a broader variety of constituencies. We talked about the child care aspects that are aimed at parents. We've talked about the Medicare that are aimed at the elderly. Climate change, you know, affects everybody. And a lot of these are, even if you're not directly affected right now, you're not elderly, but you may have parents who are facing home health care issues. So that impacts your life directly too. So the challenge is, even though it affects everybody, in some different ways, and how to target your messaging to those various demographic groups is really the challenge. That we can list all these type of benefits, but without, you know, kind of one simple way of encapsulating it, it's hard for people to wrap their heads around it and see how they benefit. And right now, it seems like the Democrats are relying on various Democratic interest groups that, you know, represent these constituencies to get that message out. You benefit in this way, but they're probably more occupied with the Washington bargaining and make sure their stuff stays in the bill than convincing their members that this is a good fit thing for them.
Mike, as I said a moment ago, when you ask average Americans, when you poll them about individual items in this bill, 70%, 70 to 75% of them say, yeah, I like that idea. That's a great idea. They may not know it's in the bill, but they like the idea of it. Do they like the idea? Has anybody polled them on the price tag? Are they put off by $3.5 trillion or even $1.5 trillion? Or do we know?
That's a good question. I am not aware off the top of my head of particular polling on the price tag, but it is, let me say this, that, you know, Republicans are acting as though the price tag is a problem. Their messaging right now is that this is a quote unquote reckless tax and spending spree, that Americans need to be concerned about it. You know, they went through a pretty radical attempt to, you know, block an increase in the debt limit, even though this, you know, the debt limit is about past spending, not future spending. They are, you know, currently trying to raise the salience of that multi-trillion dollar figure in the public's mind because they believe there is political benefit in that. So, you know, a lot of things in politics, if you look at how the other side reacts to what you're doing, it can kind of tell you a little bit about how it's playing. You know, if you ask Democrats, they wouldn't want this to be about the price tag. They'd want this to be about the policies. Awesome. But they have just been in a difficult position just because of some of the procedural things that they have to do to advance their agenda. You know, they have to jam everything into one package because they are facing the filibuster in the Senate and the need to use this convoluted reconciliation process to move forward on these things.
Deirdre.
Just to add to Mike's comments on the politics of this, I mean, the other thing that Republicans are doing are connecting the spending on this proposal to the issue of inflation and the economy. The economy tends to be the fundamental issue in midterm elections, like how you feel about how you're doing is a referendum on who is in charge of the government in Washington. In this case, Democrats control both Congress and the White House. And we just saw yesterday, you know, new figures about inflation being at a rate we haven't seen in a dozen years. And Republicans continue to tie this domestic agenda that President Biden and congressional Democrats are pushing to the idea that the cost of groceries and gas is going up. And their argument is if you spend continually, add to that government spending, you're going to see a higher hit in your wallet. So, you know, that's a debatable argument, but it's just definitely one that we can expect to continue hearing between now and the midterms, especially if they pass this bill.
We have these arguments over and over again. Has anybody ever been able to say they are right or wrong on these arguments? You would think by now economists would be able to say without question, this is right or this is not true. We can't do that?
Well, we can. The challenge is that there aren't many instances of inflation jumping up a whole lot. And we're in a situation coming out of COVID where there's so much uncertainty. No one can say that our historical models really fit the situation very well. And apart from that, you know, in terms of political evidence, people are more likely to accept their ideological evidence rather than actual evidence. So, you know, what type of evidence matters to an average swing voter is probably not very clear.
Eric, I have about 30 seconds, but Senator Joe Manchin wants to means test some of the items in this social spending bill, which would limit access to programs like paid family leave and child care. Why do progressive think that's unfair, or do they think that's unfair? I mean, if you're making over $400,000 a year, do you really need that help?
Well, they think everyone should benefit from these programs, and they think that politically they're more sustainable over the long term if the middle class thinks they benefit them, not just poor people who are less politically motivated to participate.
When we come back, we'll talk more about how this is going to be paid for if it passes. And also, is it better to go all or nothing at all? Or is it better to take what you can get now and come back to the trough later for more? We'll get to those questions in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the Build Back Better stymie in the House and Senate between the two senators and the rest of the House Democrats. Deidre Walsh reports on this for NPR. She's the congressional editor for the Washington desk there. Mike DeBonis is a congressional reporter covering both the House and the Senate for the Washington Post. And Dr. Eric Heberlig is here from UNC Charlotte, a political scientist. All this has to be paid for. And Eric, I believe the president has said it will be by taxing corporations and the rich. President Biden wants corporate taxes to be set at 28%, capital gains at 39.6%. And I should point out, the capital gains taxes don't just impact the rich. They impact anybody with a 401k. But Senator Manchin wants to keep corporate tax rates to 25% or less and the capital gains tax rate at 28%. That's a lot of numbers, or below. Can we pay a $3.5 trillion tax package if Senator Manchin gets his way?
Well, they'd have to come up with other money, other sources of money, if he has the lower tax rate on corporations, or find ways of cutting back the amount of spending, which is what Manchin also wants. So, as you pointed out earlier, many of these items are very popular with the public. Having somebody else pay for it, like corporations and rich people, is also very popular. The challenge is, you know, getting those two ends to fit together and getting a coalition in Congress to support it. What we haven't talked about is the Democrats have such narrow majorities. It's a tie in the Senate. They only have a 3-vote majority in the House. And with a parties being polarized the way they are, they're getting zero Republican support. Right. So they're literally trying to thread a needle. Any single objection from any single member of the Democratic Party is a deal breaker on this. It's an incredibly difficult challenge.
The progressives, Deirdre, like to point out that the $3.5 trillion price tag will be paid out over 10 years. Has anyone figured out what the impact of the economy on putting these features into the economy, child care, pre-K, 2 years of free community college, what that would do to GDP or to the elimination of poverty, or have they figured it out yet?
I haven't heard any sort of definitive studies about, you know, projections that they're making. I mean, just on the child tax credit, that is one provision that is actually already in effect from an earlier bill. The Congress passed a coronavirus relief bill. There are studies out that show that has already cut child poverty significantly in half. So that is one thing that Democrats are already holding up as something that is having an impact and should be continued. But, you know, I think the challenge for Democrats now is to try to figure out how they're going to scale back this package. It's not going to be a $3.5 trillion package because of what Dr. Heberling mentioned, the narrow majorities. Those divisions inside the Democratic Party are forcing Democratic leaders and the president to sort of rethink what they can put in this package. And they're sort of triaging that issue right now. The debate that's happening right now is whether all of the items that you talked about earlier can be still included in the package, but for a shorter amount of time, or whether they just leave some things, as Mike said, on the cutting room floor. Can they afford to do this very expensive expansion of Medicare coverage to cover things like hearing aids, dental treatments, and vision? Or is that something they have to set aside to do some other big priorities like these sort of ambitious climate change provisions that they have in this proposal? And that's a debate playing out now.
The pandemic revealed a widening gap between rich and poor, and some of these provisions in this Build Back Better portion of the things what we're talking about this morning would address some of those gaps. And we're told, anecdotally at least, Mike, that part of the reason the economy hasn't recovered as quickly as we had hoped, and that people are not going back to work, is because they can't find childcare. They can't do certain things because the whole system is out of whack. Does this address that? If we had these things in place, would the economy already be in better recovery mode?
That's a hypothetical question. I don't know. I mean, I can speak from, you know, personal experience and my friends and family that, you know, childcare is clearly a really significant driver of the labor shortage right now. You know, people are not, that is a factor in why people are not going back to work, among many others. And what the Democrats are proposing with, you know, they are, you know, trying to make, bring down the costs of childcare. They're looking at universal pre-K, things that could really make a difference in that area. You know, whether things in this bill would, you know, affect some of the other things happening in the labor market right now is a real question. You know, clearly, and my colleagues have done a lot of reporting about this, people are sort of reassessing their work lives right now. They're wondering whether they want to go back to low wage work, whether they want to try something different, start a new career, go back to school. These are decisions people are making, you know, partly because they got some financial wiggle room thanks to the stimulus checks, thanks to some other things that have happened during the pandemic. But, you know, it's also just people are taking this time to wonder about what do I want my life to look like going forward. And if that's what's going on, fundamentally, it can be really difficult for Washington to sort of mess with that. And I think we're going to see in the next few months how the recovery continues and how, what people do, whether wages continue to stay high, whether inflation continues, and all of that is going to sort of, you know, create this picture of the economy going forward. And I don't think anyone really has a great idea of what that's going to look like.
Eric, the Congressional Budget Office says that these bills will not pay for themselves. Instead, they will add billions of dollars to the deficit over 10 years. How reliable a predictor of such things is the CBO?
Oh, they're the best. What they can't predict, though, I mean, crystal balls are only so good. We can't really predict what crises are going to befall us in the next decade. And that's usually where these models come off.
But we know that we're not pouring tens of millions or trillions of dollars into a war in Afghanistan anymore. Is that going to help offset some of this?
I suspect they're taking that into account into their modeling. But the bottom line is, both political parties are willing to spend on things, deficit spend on things that are their priorities. And for the public, they don't like deficits. But they don't like paying taxes for things either, and they like the benefits of the spending. So in many ways, this is kind of about symbolism, and the Democrats have to make the case that if these are priorities, if these will make our economy better in the future, they're worth doing, and thus worth making the investments in.
Democrats and Republicans like what's in the infrastructure package, Mike. They both voted for it, and all cities and towns would benefit from that. Democrats really like what's in the Build Back Better part of this package. They're not getting any help on that from Republicans. And Republicans hope that they don't pass it, because if they don't pass it, then they have nothing to run on in 2022. But what's the danger here of obstructing the passage of both of those bills so that not even the infrastructure piece goes to cities and towns? What's the danger of that for Democrats?
Well, I mean, obviously we're going into a midterm year. Democrats need something to run on. They need to tell their voters that the things that they talked about in the last campaign, they delivered on. Maybe not everything, but you're in a really difficult spot if you said, well, I ran on lowering prescription drug prices, addressing climate change, go on down the list, making it, childcare more affordable to middle-class families. And if you've delivered two out of three, you at least have something to talk about. If you have zero out of three, you're really in a tough spot. I think that the Democrats are very cognizant of that, and that's driving, I think, the need to get to somewhere on this. But, we're in for at least a few more weeks, if not a couple more months, of ups and downs and internal battles before we get to a final outcome here. And it's going to be there's going to be a lot of nerves, a lot of, as we like to say in Washington, political bedwetting happening before that time. And we have in the middle of this a really interesting thing, which is the Virginia governor's race, which is really a tight race. And people are looking at that for any clues to what the political landscape looks like right now.
Mike, I think the broader challenge for Democrats here, apart from following through on discrete policy promises, is that they're kind of the party of government. They ran as the party of competence. And right now, they don't look very competent. If they can't get these fundamental things done, people are saying, well, why did we elect you? Trump is a whole lot more entertaining than you guys are. So we can stick with that if you guys, can't do the basics of legislating. Yeah. And, Biden's real appeal was that he was going to be competent. And, I'm not sure whether he could have really done the Afghanistan withdrawal any more smoothly. If the Afghanistan army is going to basically surrender, there's not a whole lot he can do about that, but it certainly made him look incompetent. And then you put these battles over legislation that Democrats say they all agree on but can't get done, and you have inflation on top of that, that's a real challenge that just pure messaging isn't going to allow them to overcome.
So we have this problem in the Democratic Party, Deirdre, I guess it's not a problem to the progressives in the party, but it's a problem for the party at large getting this through, because the progressives want it all and they want it now. And they have to do something. If they don't get anything out of this, then in the midterms, they're liable to lose the House and the Senate. So is it better? Is there anybody in the Progressive Caucus who understands that it might be better to get a little bit out of this, $1.5 trillion instead of three, and come back once they maintain control of the House and Senate or improve their prospects, come back for more in 2 years? Anybody talking like that?
You are starting to see progressives sort of dial back their demands. I mean, they said originally they wanted a $6 trillion package and their compromise was $3.5 trillion. You know, now they are starting to more publicly say, we understand there are going to need to be some give in this process. The chair of the Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal, did a conference call a couple days ago with reporters and sort of said, you know, we are okay if we do some of these programs for not the full amount of time, but what we want from those Senate moderates is more details about what they want. They want there to be sort of more specific negotiations about how you get to a compromise. So I think they are willing to give. I think they are just frustrated because they're not getting sort of detailed answers from these progressives that have sort of stalled the process, and they are negotiating directly with the White House. And just going back to the competence issue, you know, beyond President Biden's foreign policy experience, he did run on his long career in the Senate and as vice president, where he did negotiate some deals. So I think that he personally has a problem if he isn't able to broker some kind of deal. And while he's had a lot of one-on-one meetings with some of the key players here, you know, we haven't sort of seen a big heavy lift from him sort of inserting himself into the process with, I want X proposal, this proposal is the most important to me, to sort of narrow down where we could land.
Sticking with the idea of, Mike, of getting some is better than getting nothing. If they get some, then they can come back in 2 years if they maintain control of the House and Senate or increase their prospects. But if they lose control of the House and Senate because they obstruct both of these bills going forward, are the Republicans liable to come back and at least do the infrastructure part of this package? They won't do the Build Back Better part, but they might do the infrastructure. Is there any likelihood in that happening if they regain control and this doesn't happen now?
I think it would be extremely unlikely. You've already seen the House Republicans have all but boycotted the bill. You know, Kevin McCarthy, the House Minority Leader, whipped his conference against it. Former President Trump has been out there saying that he doesn't think Republicans should vote for it. He's the most powerful person in their party. I see no desire in a Republican House to deliver Joe Biden a signature victory less than 2 years before the next presidential election. I think that if it's going to happen, it's going to happen in this Congress. And if not, it's going to be at least another couple years, another presidential election is going to pass before another opportunity presents itself.
Until a week ago, Deirdre, we had another battle going on over the raising the debt ceiling, which pitted Republicans against Democrats. That's been put off till the holidays, which is not a good time to talk about this. But if any part of this passes, will that dampen Republicans' desire to see the debt ceiling raised? Will it have any impact at all over how they will treat the debate going forward on that, which has to happen by the end of the year?
I don't think so. I mean, I think it will only increase the polarization over that issue because, as Mike mentioned earlier, Republicans have argued that raising the debt ceiling makes way for this continued spending. That's not true. The debt ceiling pays for past debts. So I think that will continue to be just a really ugly partisan fight.
Deirdre Walz is a congressional editor for NPR's Washington Desk. Mike DeBonis is a congressional reporter for The Washington Post. And Dr. Eric Heberlig is a professor of political science and public administration at UNC Charlotte. We will all wait to see what happens in the coming weeks over this bill. It should be interesting. Thank you all. for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.